Audit Week continues with State Representative Ken Duncan and his challenger, Juliana Stratton. Also, Democratic presidential hopeful Rocky De La Fuente. And from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, Maracas player extraordinaire, Alcides Rodriguez. Now here's your host, a man who can also play a mean maracas, Justin Kaufman.
No, a mean maraca. Just one. Welcome, everybody, to the download tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio. Nobody does 2016 like 720. We got one heck of a show tonight. It's pretty amazing what we got planned. In our final show before the election, Blackhawks are on tomorrow and Monday. So let's get it in. On the eve of the big UIC Pavilion Trump rally, Chicago protesters are gearing up. And one person who will be there is U.S. Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He's going to join me after 7:30 tonight. Talk about why he's rallying the troops to come out to University Village tomorrow. Also tonight, we continue Candidate Week. One of the biggest races is for state representative in the 5th District of Illinois. Incumbent Ken Duncan is in the fight for his political life against challenger Juliana Stratton. This is the race that's been called a proxy for Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner, and more than $3 million has been pumped into this district. Both candidates are going to be here tonight to make their case. And Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders have grabbed up all the juice on the Democratic side of the primaries. But one man is hoping that his deep pockets and his conservative background may prove to be an alternative to the mainstream. His name is Rocky De La Fuente, and he's on the ballot for the Democratic primary in Illinois. We'll talk with him about the art of running for president when nobody is paying attention. But it's not all politics tonight. We're also going to dip into the world of arts and culture. A little fine art for you tonight, this Thursday night. Still haven't decided if what we're going to call this, but I kind of like highbrow. Martyr said highbrow. I like highbrow. I think that's good. It's going to stick. We'll talk about the big show this weekend with the Chicago Sinfonietta. We'll also talk with a soprano who's killing it on stage at the Lyric Opera. And Chicago Tribune theater critic Chris Jones will be here to preview Steppenwolf season. And talk about the price of admission for a new upcoming Goodman show, $173 a ticket. Wow. Chris says that may be the most expensive ticket in the history of not-for-profit theater in Chicago. $173. That's for the Broadway tryout this summer, War Paint. So that's coming up. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's get to it. Why don't we start with the carryout? This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The Chicago Board of Ed is suing former CEO Barbara Bird Bennett for $65 million. This after she resigned amid alleged corruption. I hope they get it, because I hope we get some of that money put back in our pockets, right? I should get $15 Barbara Bird Bennett bucks on my next tax bill. I mean, I'll even make up the bill. It's easy. I got Photoshop. Put her face right on the bill. A new UIC study says that 2015 was a very corrupt year in Illinois. From the report, in this report, we document 27 convictions, 28 indictments, and the launching of 11 corruption investigations. All of this makes us the third most corrupt state in the union. Hey, that's the bronze medal. Not so bad. Another GOP debate tonight. Party leaders are hoping for a more presidential debate, which is code for less talk about each other's junk. Sometimes when I watch the debate, I think I'm watching a really good a cappella group that, you know, sings all the parts. Like the one guy who's going, oh, boom, 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 boom. But the GOP candidates are mavericks, so they don't sing in tune. They just shout. Their new single would be called Someone Please Listen to Me. No, it's all about winning. Some other party leaders are suggesting that President Obama should be to blame for Donald Trump's success because Obama has created a polarized country, one that thrives off a divisive us versus them mentality. When reached for comment, former Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner said, yeah, what they said, it's Obama's fault. Don't call here again. Taco Bell is introducing a dollar menu for breakfast, so $1 breakfast burritos. Hey, I love value, but the old adage, you get what you pay for? Or is it, if I had a dollar for every time I ate a crappy breakfast burrito? I know there's a saying for this. Oh, that's right.
Don't eat food that's a dollar. It's a trick. A city council aviation committee backed up the mayor and pretty much told residents that they were out of luck when it came to O'Hare noise pollution. Hey, I don't get it. So what's a little noise? So some airplanes go by. You know, it reminds me of a story. And that is how dry cleaning was invented. Carbon dioxide levels increased at a record pace in 2015. Some say that the jump was explosive. Hey, maybe the Earth had one too many Taco Bell breakfast burritos. In weather, it's so cold. I hate this weather. Oh, God. In sports, Cubs' John Lester threw his first two innings today, gave up three runs, which is kind of like a shutout in spring training language. The Bears stayed quiet on day two after bringing in a couple new guys yesterday. Would like to see them do that about 25 more times, 24 more guys. Trevathan had his presser today, talked about the 85 Bears, and backpedaled like crazy, as expected. Come on, Chicago, you're so predictable sometimes. Hey, let's hope that he can backpedal like that on the field. Okay, am I right? Okay. Good news, the Bulls' Jimmy Butler looks to have had a good second opinion on that sore knee. I guess it went well with Dr. Ramsey. Butler doesn't have Tommy John. I smell something fishy here, though, because in the history of, oh, he's flying to see Dr. Ramsey, I don't think I've ever heard the, nah, knee's fine, looks great. Yeah, if anything, you can play right now. Dismissed. Butler resumes workouts today. The Northwestern Wildcats go one and done in the Big Ten tourney with an overtime loss to the Michigan Wolverines. Now the Cats cross their fingers and hope they get an at-large bid to open gym at the local high school. On the other hand, I've been saying it since the beginning. The Illini are going to win it all. They beat Minnesota yesterday, and today upset number 20, Iowa. So the Illini get number 13, Purdue, tomorrow. Don't matter. Bring on Michigan State. Bring on Maryland. Bring on Duke. Bring on Carolina. It is Illini fever, baby. Until they lose tomorrow. And I guess I should say this, that DePaul let a very unintimidating Georgetown team blow them out on day one, so they are finished in the Big East as well. And finally tonight, the new Captain America Civil War trailer was put out today. It features most of the Marvel heroes fighting against each other, but it also introduces a newly designed Spider-Man to the Avenger universe because, you know, the world can't go more than 2 years without Spider-Man. I mean, he shoots webs. So powerful. Well, that's the carryout for March 10th, 2016. Hey, we put a bunch of fries at the bottom of the bag just because we know you love the surprise.
Coming up, we're going to speak with Congressman Luis Gutierrez about the planned protests for the Trump rally at UIC Pavilion tomorrow. And it's candidate week, so Ken Duncan and Juliana Stratton will be here with their interviews. Much, much more tonight on The Download. 720 WGN. Stay with us. More to come here on The Download tonight. Big night. Politics, man. Everywhere. Everywhere I turn, Rob Martier, there are just politics.
I think I've reached kind of like mass saturation right now.
We got a couple of months. This is just the beginning, right?
as we kind of get down on, you know, to the head-to-head matchup, then, right, you know, it'll pick back up for
you'll
me. Take,
you'll be able to hit the reset button.
Well, you know, as I said to Pete before the show tonight, I basically intercom down to him. I said, you know, if another GOP debate takes place in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it actually make a noise?
It really is, right?
And that's where I am tonight.
Oh, my gosh. Well,
that's all right. It's all
I mean,
good.
Good thing is we at least will, in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Ken Duncan and Juliana Stratton. At least that's local, right? I mean, at least it's not just the over and over and over with the – I mean, this, I think, is the 12th GOP debate that's tonight.
I lost count at like 9. But you know, this race that you're going to be talking about tonight is very interesting because of the president component and what people feel about that.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, the GOP debate is just moments away. And after that debate, I'm assuming Donald Trump's going to go to like 19 states before he gets to Chicago tomorrow, to Illinois. Tomorrow, Donald Trump holding a rally at the UIC Pavilion. His political rallies have been making news lately because of the constant clashes between supporters and protesters and even some of Trump's security. Tomorrow could be a big night for protests in Chicago. Several groups are planning to attend the event and demonstrate their dislike for the leading GOP candidate. One of the protests will surround Trump's words on immigration, which are obviously very, very controversial, and it will include Chicago Congressman Luis Gutierrez, who joins me now. Congressman Gutierrez, thanks for coming on the show.
It's really good to be with you this evening.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I mean, you said you plan to stand by and stand with the protests that are being organized and orchestrated for Trump coming to Chicago tomorrow. Why?
Because Chicago is a city that I love. I was born in Chicago in the 1950s. I like Chicago a lot more in 2016 than in 1956. To go to my grandson's seventh grade, you know, his birthday party, and he introduces me to Julie, one of his friends, and she has two dads. And, like, for little kids, it doesn't make any difference. I like that people no longer have to hide who they are and that the Supreme Court has issued a ruling on marriage equality. I like the fact that women have more rights and control over their reproductive rights. I like to see that immigrants are finally getting a fair hearing and that we can make progress to fix our broken immigration system. So when I hear Donald Trump, it's almost like, you know, it's Sarah Palin on steroids. The Republican Party keeps saying, well, how did we get to where we're at? Because you've been out there against Planned Parenthood. You've been attacking, and you've been attacking gay people. And you've been in, you know, the environment. There's no problem with the environment. Global warming doesn't exist. You're deniers about so many things. And, you know, I just want to say, as a member of Congress, you know, I earn in one month of my salary, what a minimum wage earner earns in a whole year. And they want to know why we think there's such a disconnectedness.
Let me ask you this.
For all of those reasons, I'm going to be there tomorrow.
Well, let me ask you, I mean,
specifically. Go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, the one thing that's interesting, I mean, even news today, once again, you know, we keep seeing these constant clashes between protesters and even the rhetoric from the podium as you know, Mr. Trump continues to say, you know, things as the protesters are being thrown out of his rallies. There's just this, there's a real sort of, I don't know, like a conflict that's happening. What do you say to people who are going down to a rally, a protest? What do you say about that sort of that vitriol and everything that's coming out of the Trump rallies we've been seeing around the country?
Sure. So let me just say this. Look, we're going to be across the street. Everybody should have free access. All of his supporters should be free to enter and gain access to his rally tomorrow. We're going to be across the street. And I'm going to leave in about 45 minutes to attend the beginning of a vigil that will last all night long with men and women of faith in the city of Chicago that will be standing outside the pavilion all night and through until the speech is given tomorrow. So I'm going to tell you, I want people to go in peace. I want people to be nonviolent. I want people to say, raise their voices against bigotry, defend the country. We've worked so hard to weave this wonderful American society that we all live in, to stand up and say, you know, religious, there should be no religious tests in America. That's why people fled and created this country of ours, so that they can freely express themselves religiously. We shouldn't have a religious test and say that Muslims need not apply, need never come to America, that they're a threat to our society. And Chicago, I mean, Chicago's a city of neighborhoods, right? Of Polish and Ukrainian and Chinese and Korean and Mexican, Puerto Rican. I mean, so many wonderful neighborhoods. We've learned to live with one another, and we've learned to strengthen the city of Chicago. So I want to say no to those who bring that kind of vitriolic hatred and division in their campaign. So he's coming tomorrow. I'll tell you what, 6 o'clock, I'm leaving. Trump begins, and I'm going to encourage everybody to leave. I'm sure there are those who will listen, and I'm sure there are many who might not. I'm going to tell you how I'm going to comport myself and how I would ask others. Go protest, raise your voice, and when we're done and they begin, then let's leave. And let's leave all of those who leave the Trump rally, leave in peace too, so that we avoid. Most of the people that we're are not going in. We're not going in. I understand why people would go in. And let me just say, I've been to a lot of rallies with thousands of people. I've seen Barack Obama heckled by Democrats. Okay, and you know, nobody gets beat up. He doesn't say go punch him. He says it doesn't say, oh, by the way, go punch him, knock their lights out, and by the way, don't worry about the legal bill. I'm going to take care of it. And he doesn't have campaign managers that throw to the ground reporters because they think that they're the opposition reporters of the mainstream and weren't their friends from Breitbart. So all I have to say is, if you look at the conduct at these rallies, I think it's not befitting the great American tradition. Politicians have to have thin skin. He obviously doesn't, and he has a propensity to violence at his rally. So tomorrow we're going to raise our voice in defense of just the greatest and the finest tradition. Again, 1950s, separate but equal, right? That's the world I was born into.
Yeah.
Today I'm a member of Congress.
Let me ask you.
I like the new America.
Yeah, right. Let me ask you, because you know, one of the issues that Donald Trump has stirred up so much emotion in is immigration. You know, he's gone on record saying he wants to build a big wall between Mexico and the United States. You've been a pro-immigration mover in Congress. I mean, that's been really one of your platforms that you've been involved in. When you see candidates take on that kind of anti-immigration stance, and you see that there's a fervor for, I mean, there are people who want to hear that. What does it do for you as someone who has spent years of your life working towards, you know, an immigration policy for the country?
Let me put it to you from a personal perspective. So when my mom and dad came in 1952 from Puerto Rico, they came as American citizens. But they came speaking only the Spanish language and from a Latin American country with American citizenship. So when they came here, look, Puerto Ricans were bringing tropical diseases that we needed to be aware of. We simply came to sign up for welfare. We were dangerous and had propensity to violence and to criminal activity. Kind of like what they said about the Irish 100 years before the Puerto Ricans. And it's the same rhetoric today, isn't it? About Mexicans, the murderers, the rapists, the criminals that are crossing our border to cause harm. I look at Pilsen. I look at Little Village. I look at Jesus Garcia, just ran for mayor of the city of Chicago, naturalized citizen, right? I look at Danny Solis, alderman of the 25th Ward, naturalized citizen, wasn't born here. I look at Ricardo Munoz and Alderman Cardenas, and I see so many. I'm giving those as examples of elected officials. But like them, there are hundreds of thousands in the city of Chicago. Not all of them came with their documents and properly in order, but all of them today are contributing so vastly to the greatness of the city of Chicago. Where would we be without that Latino community? 25% of the city of Chicago, and making it stronger every day.
Let me ask you this, because you know, the president has made, you know, immigration one of his he ran on immigration reform for both of his sins. As he wraps up his final term in office, and, you know, it's an election year, so there's not a lot that's supposed to get done at that time. Where does he stand on what did he get done when it comes to immigration? And was it enough for Congressman Luis Gutierrez?
Look, the president and I find ourselves at a very good place in our political relationship and in our personal relationship. I think that he has moved in the right direction. You know, in about 5 weeks, they'll be making some oral arguments at the Supreme Court, whether the president overreached in his executive authority. And I'm just for your radio audience, here's what the president said. Since Congress doesn't want to act on our broken immigration system, we have 5 million American citizen children whose parents are undocumented, means they have no paper, who are at risk of being deported. If they come forward, you know, at their own expense and go through a background check to show that they have no criminal background and they want to register with the government, I'm going to give them a 2-year work permit, keep them on a short leash and let them work and let them raise those American citizen children. The Supreme Court is going to decide whether he overreached in his executive authority in granting that. You know that in the city of Chicago, there are tens of thousands, 750,000 across the country, tens of thousands here in the city of Chicago, of young immigrants who came as children. Today they have work permits. I'd like everybody just to recall one moment back, 2012, in the summer of 2012, August of 2012, Navy Pier, when 15,000 people lined up to apply to get their papers straight with the American government. So I think the Supreme Court is going to make a decision pretty soon. So we'll know in June.
Right.
I think that's going to it's going to be the greatest part of his testament as the president
well,
of the
I mean,
United States.
Well, I mean, is it what you expected? I mean, as someone who was really advocating for immigration reform, you know, put your support behind the president 8 years ago. Was it what you expected? I mean, at the end, 8 years later?
No, it wasn't. I expected him to do more, to make it a higher priority. But I'm happy that today we're in a place where he's doing all that he can. I'm happy to watch a debate yesterday between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, in which they both said that we shouldn't be destroying and dividing families because the Congress won't act. And while there are no parallels that are ever exact, I want your radio audience to understand, and my fellow Chicagoans and those that listen to you beyond, look, presidents take action. President Lincoln took an action. He didn't have a vote in Congress before he freed the slaves and before he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. He signed it as president of the United States. That was a good thing. Of course, we had to amend the Constitution after the Civil War to guarantee that those slaves were guaranteed American citizenship. So there was one thing that the president did, and then there was another action taken by Truman, 1948. We just defeated fascism in Asia and in Europe, right? Yet we still had our armed forces that were segregated. He desegregated the armed forces of the United States 15 years before we passed the Civil Rights Act. He took that action. We are all happy that somebody issued the Emancipation Proclamation, that Truman desegregated the armed forces in 1948. And I got to tell you, in the end, I think we're going to look back at this history and we're going to say, why would we divide families of people that have American citizen children that are working hard, sweating and toiling, and that are neighbors? It's not a good way to go about treating millions of people in this country. Yes, they are undocumented. We should make them register with the government, pay a fine, learn English, pay their taxes, and after a certain amount of time, whether it's 10 years or more, allow them to apply to American citizenship so they can integrate themselves. And then, you want to secure that border? It's the best way to secure the border. Make sure that anybody that comes to the United States and gets a job has to be certified by the federal government before they can be hired. And if they're hired without that certification and not that verification, let's put those people in jail. In the meantime, we can't round up 11 million people. Imagine what that would be in the city of Chicago, rounding up 250,000 people in our neighborhood. It's not something that's in our tradition as Americans.
Congressman Luis Gutierrez, 4th District here, representing parts of Chicago. Let me ask you just quick. I mean, you've endorsed Hillary Clinton in the primary. Tell us why. Why Hillary over Senator Sanders?
I think she's our best option to win in November, and I want to win. There's going to be a Supreme Court. Look, whether they accept Barack Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court or not, a Democrat's going to make the next nomination. It's going to be a 5-4 court. 5-4 court. I got to tell you, I remember the kind of, you know, lack of freedom, the kind of lack of democracy that there was for my mom and women in the 50s. We've worked really hard so that the Supreme Court and the laws of our nation so that, and it's the law of the land, women should control their reproductive rights. Women should control the decisions they make, and those decisions between them and their doctors, not between them and the government. And so I want to keep that. As I suggested to you earlier, I'm happy people are out of the closet. I think it's a much more friendlier, much freer, much more democratic, and much more just world in which people can express themselves. I don't want to turn the clock back on those. And you know, I want to see workers' rights guaranteed to collective bargaining and to make sure, God, everybody, come on. I want all your listeners to think one moment. Do you really want to go buy a cheeseburger? Do you really want to go eat a taco? Do you really want to buy a pair of shoes? Do you really want to go to an establishment and have somebody serve you that doesn't at least earn $15 an hour? I mean, $30,000 a year doesn't get you far in the city of Chicago. $15 an hour. You know, we should have to stop talking about minimum wage. We should begin to talk about living wage. So, look, there's a lot at stake. I think Hillary Clinton is our best alternative to winning next November. And so that's why I support her.
Okay.
And I think next week in Chicago, in Illinois, she's going to have a big win.
Luis Gutierrez, Congressman of the 4th District in the state of Illinois, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. All right. Good being with you. Thank you so much.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Big show tonight with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up later in the show, once we get past the politics stuff, we're going to talk arts and culture, a little fine art for you. Chicago Sinfonietta will be here. We'll be talking about their show BYOB, Bring Your Own Beat. It's going to be in Naperville on Saturday and at the Symphony Center here in Chicago on Monday. It's essentially a show that features percussion. And we're going to talk with Alcides Rodriguez, who is a from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, but he's a maestro when it comes to the maracas. So we're going to talk with him coming up. Also from the Lyric Opera, Der Rosenkavalier is on stage at the Lyric Opera. I'm very excited to talk with Amanda Majewski. Yeah, that's right. She's a soprano. She's a lead. She's amazing. She was in Fiddler on the Roof before she did this show, and she's going back to do Fiddler on the Roof in New York. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, not yeah, right. Marriage of Figaro. That's right. Thank you, Pete. Pete's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, yeah, Marriage of Figaro. Sorry, let me take that back. That tells you what I know about. That's why this is a perfect segment. Highbrow. She's doing Marriage of Figaro. Figaro at Lyric she did in the fall, and she's doing Figaro at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City coming up this spring. So we'll talk with her. And Chris Jones, the Chicago Tribune theater critic, will be here. We'll talk about the upcoming Steppenwolf season they just announced. And also about this story he had in the paper today about the tickets for the Goodman Theater. $173 are the tickets for the show this summer. It's a pre-Broadway show. We'll talk to him about that, why it's so expensive. He believes the most expensive in not-for-profit history, not-for-profit theater history. So that's coming up. Anyway, coming up next, Candidate Week, we're going to be talking with incumbent Ken Duncan and also Juliana Stratton about the race in the 5th District of Illinois for state representative. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Tonight, we finish off Candidate Week. There's several tight races in the area, and we here on the download wanted to introduce you to some of the candidates running for office in the Illinois primary, which will be decided on Tuesday, March 15th. Instead of a debate format, we've decided to go back-to-back, give each candidate equal time and similar questions and topics. And joining me tonight to help with the interviews, as he has all week long, Mike Fouché. Mike Fouché is the man behind AlderTrack.com, subscription news site covering all things Chicago politics. Good to see you.
Yeah, I jumped the gun there.
No. I like it.
Yeah.
Tonight, probably one of the more interesting races shaping up in Illinois. It's the Democratic primary for state representative in the 5th District of Illinois. It's between incumbent Democrat Ken Duncan, challenger Juliana Stratton. Lots of ink, lots of money, and lots at stake for the future of the state of the Illinois. It's amazing in this one Chicago district. First up tonight, incumbent Ken Duncan. Duncan's been serving in the 5th District since 2002. Before that, he was the director of the Robert Taylor Boys and Girls Club. Mr. Duncan, representative, good to see you.
Hey, good evening. Good to see you guys.
And we've had you on before, so I'm glad that you came back. And you know, last time we had you on, we were talking about that big vote, that labor vote, that really kind of kicked this whole campaign off for you because you didn't vote when it came down to what Speaker Madigan needed you to vote to get the veto. Let's talk about what's your thoughts on this reelection campaign for you? Because you have pretty much run almost unopposed your entire time since 2002, and you're looking at, you know, the political fight for your life here.
Yes, this is quite a roller coaster ride these days, given the fact that all I'm trying to do is find solutions for people in the state of Illinois. I happen to be an independent Democrat who wants to get to a bottom line, such as a budget, such as funding for some of our most vulnerable citizens, try to help the Chicago public school system, try to come up with ways to incentivize businesses to come into all aspects, all areas of our community here in the city of Chicago, in East St. Louis, in Kankakee, in Rockford, some of these areas where they have just been devastated and ravaged with companies leaving. People want to work. They want quality schools. They don't want this sort of juvenile bickering down in Springfield or in any form of government.
So, Representative, let's throughout just kind of some scene setting here. You are locked in probably the most expensive state rep race, definitely the most expensive primary
in history,
ever
in
history. Right now, our numbers show $3.6 million has been committed between the two campaigns and independent expenditures. And there's probably going to be maybe 14,000 people that are going to vote in this primary, right? So that's a lot of money per person. A lot of this started back in, this all goes back to September, as Justin just said, about there was a vote that you did not attend to, that you missed, which was a pro-labor vote where the Democrats were attempting to override a veto from Governor Brawner. And you didn't come. You instead said you were going to be in New York City. And actually, Representative Esther Gohler, who has died, she came from her deathbed in order to go vote. So, you know, why did you miss this? How did all this get started?
Well, Mike, Esther Gohler was a friend of mine, and why she left her sick bed to come down because the speaker asked her is something that I certainly would have done. The bill, by the way, was an arbitration bill that the unions felt as if it would benefit them. I'm a 90-plus percentile voter with unions in this state because I believe unions have a place in the state of Illinois. The bill fell by 3 votes. I voted for it before in May of 15. I would have voted for it had I been here, but I told the speaker that I wasn't going to be there. Had I been here, the bill would not have passed. Senate Bill 1229, which lost by 3 votes, wouldn't have passed. And you know what? Quite frankly, what's wrong with having an elected official be at the arbitration table to talk about the citizens' financial involvement with the state workers, right? Not some arbitrator. We do that for fire and police. This is much to do about nothing. At the end of the day, it was whether the unions were going to get a leverage up on the governor and have the people pay for it.
Well, why do you think that you were singled out? Why do you think that you became the poster child for Speaker Madigan to say we need better Democrats who are going to keep this supermajority in place?
Because Speaker Madigan is not used to people coming off of his reservation. He is not used to people being there with their own independent mindset, per se, and taking action. And so this leads to October, when the governor committed to myself, Senator Toy Hutchison, State Representative John Gordon, that he was going to restore funding for child care, funding for the developmentally disabled, as well as our seniors.
So you've built a pretty strong relationship with Governor Brawner.
Merely by communicating, which is something that the Speaker of the House has not elected to do or to be a part of. He's isolated himself from negotiation, even with Senate President Cullerton, Leader Redonio in the Senate, House Leader Republican Jim Durkin. He is the only one that's not talking, and he hasn't spoken, had a real substantive sit-down since May of 2015. I find that offensive.
Okay, well, now you had a really strong relationship with Governor Rod Blagojevich, too. And in 2009, you skipped the impeachment vote for Governor Blagojevich, and you decided to stay in the Caribbean instead. Then, so is this something that you like to do? I mean,
that's sensational sort of media journalism because they're not used to Mike Madigan not having his way. Mike, the fact is, it was a sort of a fait accompli. The Governor Blagojevich was going to be impeached, and quite frankly, at the end of the day, so what? The people in Illinois could have cared less. You know what people care about? This pension debt at $111 billion. They care about the quality of our schools and how they're funded. They care about the efficiency of what it is that we're spending. And quite frankly, in this race, I'm the only person talking about issues of substance, not lambasting Ken Duncan's past of 21 years ago, talking about whether I served prison time, which was not true, about me getting into a fight on the street with another male, some guy.
No, let's stick to the issues. The issues are more fun. I mean, because
I know what
a lot
concept
of stuff that's here, right?
What a concept.
I mean, so let me ask you about an issue thing. I mean, Governor Brawner, you've had a good communication with him. So what's he doing wrong? If when you talk to him next, what do you say? Hey, Bruce, you're really messing up.
I have, and you sound exactly like me. I said, Governor, what in the hell is wrong with you? You are starving citizens here at the most vulnerable state that I've ever seen. This is the ninth month. First off, why did you veto my higher education bill? So schools like Chicago State, Western, and Northeastern Illinois, and all of the other state universities, let alone coupled with the human services, the general services, the public safety budget. How dare you? What is wrong that we can't come up with a compromise? And he tells me, you gave me a budget with $3.5 to $4 billion out of whack. So all I'm doing is challenging and pressing him and try my best to persuade him to see things from a different perspective. But I'm the only Democrat that's talking with him. And in politics, guys, you have to communicate with people whether you like them or not at work. Politicians negotiate all the time. We compromise all the time. But if you're not getting together, seeking solutions for the people in this state who we don't discriminate when it comes to taxing at the sales register, at the income tax level, at the fee level. We're expecting you as citizens to do what you're supposed to do and you better do. But we don't have that same standard for us to get a budget in the ninth month with starving mental health services. The Chicago Public Schools are talking about going on strike. We don't have a plan to deal and address our pension issues. Mike Madigan has been trying to do this for, I guess, well, he's been in office for 45 years. And I'm supposed to stay on his program, and he has zero-sum solutions. We're in the ninth month. He can't even go and talk to the governor? Come on.
Representative Ken Duncan is in studio with us. He's running for re-election in the 5th District of Illinois. We're going to take a break. We'll come back more with Representative Duncan. It's candidate week here on the download on WGN 720. All right, in studio with us right now, incumbent Ken Duncan, state representative of 5th District of Illinois, which is really a Chicago district, covers pretty much a full swath of Chicago from the north side to the south side. We're going to be talking coming up after the break with his challenger, Juliana Stratton. Let me ask you this, Representative Duncan, to start us off a second time. I mean, there has been so much made of President Obama coming to Chicago, the president of the United States, to endorse your opponent. You were in office when he was in office. You guys had a nice little exchange when he came to Springfield. Talk about his endorsement of your opponent.
The president hasn't made, to my knowledge, an endorsement in the United States Senate race here in Illinois. Is he with Hillary or is he with Bernie? Has he made up his mind in that direction?
Yeah, he stayed out of that.
I don't know. Has he made a decision in any congressional race? Has he made a decision in the heated state's attorney's race? Has he chimed in on the Flint, Michigan issue?
No. In fact, they had a press conference the other day. There's Lynn Sweet reported there's only two races he's made endorsements. It's this race and Rob Portman for U.S. Senate in Ohio.
That's amazing, given the fact that, I mean, has he said anything about the Laquan McDonald issue? I mean, I don't know, but I am amazed that a sitting U.S. president, leader of the free world, is in a local state house race, and he can't vote for neither one of us. Having said that, I'm a huge fan of the president. I plan on being at the White House next Thursday, next Friday.
He invited you, right? You're going to go after Election Day.
It's on my calendar.
Nobody can see the face you just
That's
made.
Quite a pause there.
It was a face for radio.
And my thing is, we have some very serious issues. I would love for the president to come and broker a deal, a communique, facilitate and arbitrate even with the governor, us Democrats, the Republicans, and we craft a budget. Mm-hmm. I would love for the president to come with a state of emergency funding for job training, for job allocation infrastructure for the South and the West sides of Chicago to really stem this abject poverty and violence that is existing that's plaguing our city and our state. I would love for him to come and really chime in on having us come up with a way that we can stabilize his home state disproportionately with federal resources to address homeless issues, to address the mental health crisis that exists, mm-hmm. to stop these red light cameras, for crying out loud, that the U.S. Attorney's Office, federal, again, has found Mike Madigan's top precinct captain and all of his, they found him guilty and all of the people who fed off of that, this red light camera phenomenon. You should read the federal testimony last month of all the players who were involved out of Madigan's organization.
So, you know, when we, during the break, we were talking a little bit about how you haven't heard anything from all these people that you helped or you feel that you helped at one time or another. And, you know, we were talking specifically about how you feel that you took leadership on the civil unions and the equal marriage bill that State Rep Greg Harris put together and put forward. And you, as head of the Black Caucus, you took a lot of hits trying to push that through. And you haven't heard anything from folks that you helped on that particular bill. And so when you talk to those people, though, and I have, and I've talked to Greg Harris and others, is that they feel that you are abandoning the Democratic Party. And that in this case with Bruce Rauner, it's a either you stand together or you hang separately, and that you've broken out. And so now
you call yourself an independent Democrat, but a lot of people who are criticizing you say you're just a Republican.
You know what? That is a piss poor excuse for us not having a budget or communicating. It's a sad and pathetic excuse because they, some of them, not all of them, but enough of them are intimidated, are simply scared to step out of the same old activity that we've been engaging in Springfield that has led us here today with the ninth month of no budget. There is no reason why my colleagues should not want to deal with this or address this impasse. Why are we allowing Mike Madigan not to speak or address and negotiate with this governor? There's no excuse for it.
Why do you think that we haven't had it? Why do you think that we haven't had it? We don't have a budget. Who's at fault for not having a budget in Springfield?
Well, first off, the governor vetoed everything except elementary and secondary education. All right. And so we did give him a budget that was almost $4 billion out of whack, in all fairness. But now the only person who is not communicating with the governor is Michael J. Madigan. I'm not sure if it's because of his 45-year reign. I mean, this guy wrote the Illinois Constitution. Mike Boss said it best in his rant. Let my people go. He's now a congressman, Mike Boss, down in Southern Illinois. He talked about the concentration of all power. Everything is in one person's hand. And now he is coming to the 5th Representative District trying to dictate to the locally elected officials who their next state representative is going to be. That is the most disgusting and pathetic approach towards a Democratic government.
I want to ask you a quick question. If you are reelected, will you vote for Mike Madigan for speaker?
No.
Okay. So he's not going to be helping you out.
Well, here's the reality. You know, I have a 90%+ voting record with all the unions. I have even the highly discriminatory, racist trade unions. You can go down to McCormick Place if you want to see. Look at some of these vertical construction buildings. Look at the road contractors. That'll speak for itself. Again, we don't discriminate when it comes to spending money or taxing anybody in the state. But in terms of fairness and the unions, and look at outside of the teachers union, Chicago Teachers Union, all the leadership is white. Listen, I don't want to get too deep into a white-black issue, but the fact of the matter is the speaker wants to set a tone.
So wait a minute. You're saying that labor is a white organization.
White-led.
And that because it's white-led.
Ask me, SEIU, all the trades.
People of color can't count on it.
What I'm saying is, we've benefited largely in the service unions. We have major issues and challenges in these trade unions. And for the speaker to tell them to spend $1.5 million with my opponent, who they never even met, he's allowing himself and the Democratic Party of Illinois to attack me. And I have been a staunch Democrat. My Democratic record would run circles on about 80% of the members of the House. That's how proud of a Democrat I am. And because I'm just saying, listen, let's move off the dime and come up with a solution by way of communication and compromise. That makes me a person with leprosy.
Let me ask you this last question. Let's say that you do win the primary on Tuesday. Is it irreparable, the damage between you and the speaker, the relationship? I mean, are you going to be a part of the Democratic Party if the majority stands? I mean, are you going to be voting in step with Democrats, or... You know, are you more with the money that was given to you? Are you now more of a router guy?
That's a, my, you should ask my opponent if she will ever go against Mike Madigan. The question is, the real question is, how is it and what is it that we need to do to move the state forward? There's no one who can even, Mike Madigan, I'm not down there to satisfy him. I'm down there to represent the wonderful constituents of the 5th District. I'm a Democrat. No one's going to take that away from me. The Democrat, us Democrats have made gross mistakes before, and certainly on this issue, it's they're way out of line. So you had Scott Drury, you had Jack Franks voted against the union arbitration bill and other measures. Are they less Democratic? Why aren't they experiencing right. what I'm experiencing? They're so, you know, the hypocrisy has to stop in government. And the fact of the matter is, the citizens in my district have a choice of either working with me as an independent who I can work with anybody, not to be a puppet of Bruce Rauner or Mike Madigan, but it's about getting something done. But if my opponent is successful, let's say hypothetically, that means she is going to go back on this program, this reservation, and get dictated to by the person who's been in office for 45 years, whose only purpose and goal in life is to stay the speaker and not be motivated to get solutions or get things done here for the citizens of the state of Illinois.
State Representative Ken Duncan, he's running for re-election in the 5th Representative District here in the state of Illinois. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Said earlier tonight, we finish off Candidate Week. It's been a great week of different candidates running for local races. We had state's attorneys on Tuesday.
This is my dream week.
State Senate race on Monday. Lots of races in the area. Mike Fouché is here from AlderTrack.com to be my co-host.
Living the
this
dream.
Whole week. Living the dream. We're talking about the 5th District, the race for state, the 5th Representative District of Illinois. Next up, challenger in the 5th, Juliana Stratton. She's a director of the Center for Public Safety and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Before that, she was the executive director of the Cook County Justice for Children. She's a lawyer, mediator, and advocate, and she joins me tonight. Thanks for being here, Ms. Stratton.
You're welcome. Good evening. Glad to be here.
Why don't we start? I mean, what's getting you into politics? I mean, you've done a lot of work. You've been a professor, like I just said, a lawyer. What is it about getting into politics, and why run for office here in the 5th?
Well, I've been in public service for my entire career. I am a lawyer, but throughout my 20 plus year career, I've always worked with governmental agencies and entities, and as a mediator working on employment discrimination cases for a number of governmental agencies. I was a deputy hearing commissioner for the city's Department of Business Affairs and Consumer Protection, working on how to make sure that businesses and communities are good neighbors. In 2011, I joined the administration of Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle as the director of the Justice Advisory Council, where I advised on criminal and juvenile justice reform for the president's office. And now I'm with the University of Illinois at Chicago as the director of the Center for Public Safety and Justice. So throughout my career, I've been in public service. I've been an advocate. I focused on problem solving, and I really see running for office and being in elected office really just a way of extending the reach of that advocacy and that problem solving skills.
So how did you get recruited to run for this? I mean, who first suggested that you would run against Ken Duncan?
Well, first of all, let me say in 2011, I was in a program called Illinois Women's Institute for Leadership, which trains women to run for political office statewide. So as I just talked about, public service has always been in my mind. Around 2011, I started thinking about preparing myself for elected office. I saw that as potentially something in my future. I've always kind of kept my eyes and ears open about what might be coming down the pipeline, where some opportunities might present themselves. And so then when Representative Duncan missed some key votes in September and then again in November, again, I'm a resident of the 5th District, and I was really disturbed by that. And so I started just having some conversations. Clearly, in the work that I've done, I know a lot of people who, both elected officials and otherwise, who work in government. I've worked on campaigns, and it was a conversation that just started. So I wouldn't use any particular word like recruitment. I would say that this was something that there were mutual conversations that started to take place.
Well, it was a very memorable press conference where you had a lot of big big name Democrats that were standing behind you, including Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. But when you announced that you were going to be running or getting endorsements from the key Democrats, talk about this. This race has really just sort of catapulted to the top of the list when it comes to interests in the city of Chicago. And a lot of people have said it's a proxy, that it's Speaker Madigan versus Governor Rauner. Governor Rauner's PACs giving money to Representative Duncan and Speaker Madigan supporting your candidacy. Talk about that. I mean, when they say proxy, I mean, is this really about Speaker Madigan versus Governor Rauner?
Well, so I know that that's how it's often framed in the media. I've been talking to residents for the last several months, literally 6 to 7 hours every day, knocking on doors. And that's not what the residents of the district are talking about. They're talking about the fact that they feel that there's been a void of leadership in the 5th District. They're talking about the issues that are affecting their everyday lives, such as when those votes were missed, how they were cut from child care assistance and affordable child care. I've heard other families talk about the concern about being cut from important medical care or people with disabilities being cut from services. Those are the things that I'm hearing on a day-to-day basis. None of the residents that I'm talking to in the 5th District are trying to frame it as some sort of proxy war.
So you've gotten an unheard of amount of money, millions of dollars for your campaign or expended on your behalf. We're at $3.6 million that's been committed between the two campaigns at this point. How can you possibly demonstrate independence after getting all this money and support if you're elected?
Well, I think I look at my career as someone who's had to serve as a neutral and somebody who takes information in and has to make an independent decision. That's what I've done for 20 plus years of my career. As a mediator, as an arbitrator, as an administrative judge, my role has been to take all of the information that's been presented, look at the evidence, and make a decision that's not as a mediator, because that's the parties making the decision, but in many of my roles, I've had to make a decision based upon all of the information presented. And I think what I would do as a legislator and as the representative in the 5th District is be able to take what's important to the residents of the district. And I really do believe, based upon all the conversations, and I've talked with thousands of people, that if I keep what they've told me at the forefront, if I listen to them, if I keep the lines of communication open, if I'm educating the community, hey, this is what's happening in Springfield, let's talk about how it affects your daily lives. And they also say to me, hey, Juliana, let us tell you some things that are going on in our community you should know about. I really do believe if we keep the people first, then it's going to be something that will allow for the kind of independence which says, I was elected to do a job. I was elected to represent the people of
the
district.
Well, Ken Duncan says that he's doing this for the people. He's being an independent guy, and he's tired of wearing Mike Madigan's yoke, and so he's breaking out for the people.
He's breaking out for the people, he says, to the tune of first a $500,000 campaign donation from Republican friends and allies of Governor Rauner, and that has only built from there. Another $300,000 last week, and I think I've seen last Friday, and I think I've seen another several hundred thousand. I mean, no one that I'm talking to in the 5th District, none of the residents believe that he's independent. Most of the residents, and if not all of the residents that I've talked to, don't see him as somebody sort of breaking out for them. They see him as someone who has turned his back on them and someone who has now formed an alliance with a governor who has an agenda that is really anti-family, anti-middle and struggling working class families, and that they now feel like Ken Duncan is helping him to advance that agenda.
In 9 months without a budget in Springfield. I mean, yeah, everyone knows this at this point, but a lot of residents of the 5th are affected by this. I mean, social service cuts down the line. You hear Representative Duncan say that, you know, this is something that, you know, the communication between Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner is not there, that we're letting politics get in front of the budget. What's your answer to why a budget hasn't gotten done?
Well, I think first and foremost that, as I just said, and I don't want to be a broken record, but I think first and foremost, we have not put what's in the best interest of the people of this state as the number one priority. So when we keep people at the forefront, then there's no way that I could see that you would cut everything from you know, services to homeless students, to services for seniors. I mean, these are, you know, taking care of children and the most vulnerable seniors, the most vulnerable in our community. That's just unheard of to me. Having said that, I also know that we do have a governor who did not campaign on his turnaround agenda. And yet now, as we head into the ninth month without a budget, he has really, from my estimation, decided that he's not willing to really negotiate in good faith without seeing that turnaround agenda move forward. And so that's a problem because
that's it? I mean, is there nowhere to go? He wants the turnaround agenda, so there's nothing that can be offered. We're at an impasse.
So I believe that as the governor, then his number one responsibility is to help get a budget passed. I mean, that, and I do believe that he's abdicated that responsibility. Look, I agree with what President Obama said when he came to address the Illinois General Assembly several weeks ago, when he talked about the need to be able to reach across the aisle to try to work and find points of compromise. But I think he also made it very clear that you don't do that to the extent where you are sacrificing what's important to the residents that you were elected to represent. And that was the problem with Representative Duncan. He talks about being independent, that he's now working with Governor Rauner because he thinks that that's a way to negotiate. You don't negotiate when it hurts the people that you were elected to represent. There's some things that are negotiable, and quite frankly, there are some things that aren't. And if it's going to continue to be on the backs of families that are already struggling, I don't see that that's an area that you're able to negotiate.
Juliana Stratton is the challenger in the 5th District for state representative. Let's take a break. When we come back, more with this conversation.
Thank you.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mike Fouché is with me tonight. It's Candidate Week. In studio with us, Juliana Stratton. She is the challenger in the 5th District state representative race against incumbent Ken Duncan. We're talking about the budget impasse, this kind of thing. So one of the big ticket items of this race is the President of the United States endorsing you over Ken Duncan. We were just talking about how he's only really spoken on two races in the entire country. It's got to be great to have the president's support, especially, you know, here in Chicago. But is it strange to have the president of the United States endorse
you guys
for state rep?
Do you hang out?
Well, it's never happened to me before.
Sure.
So I've never had his endorsement before. So it's a little strange. But in all seriousness, I am thrilled to have the endorsement of President Obama. I am very grateful that in his endorsement, he recognized that we have shared values and what we would like to see happen in our communities and in our neighborhoods. And I think it just speaks to the fact that he believes, quite frankly, that I can provide better leadership for the 5th District. And for that, I'm extremely grateful.
Have you met him before?
I have met him before, briefly.
Pre or post becoming president? Because he lived just down the street from you. Okay.
Post.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, and what'd you guys talk about?
Well.
Classified, right?
Yeah. Well, I worked on his campaign.
Okay, cool.
And as many others did in this city, and his reelection campaign.
Uh-huh.
And so I was working out of the Hyde Park office.
Okay.
And I don't know if either of you remember this, but on the morning of the election day.
Yeah.
He came into the Hyde Park office.
Uh-huh.
And so all I know is someone said, okay, leave your bag, step outside. Dogs were coming in. Everything was real quick. And I see the presidential motorcade driving up right on 51st Street in some space that used to be like a pancake house or something.
Yeah, that's not even there anymore.
It's not even there anymore. Yeah. And then there was President Obama. And he just came in and he greeted people. He made a couple of calls to voters. And I tell you that even in my campaign right now, one thing that I learned from that interaction and the reaction that people had from him talking to not only the volunteers, but talking to people who were going to vote for him and making calls is the importance of connecting with the residents. And that's what I've been doing in this campaign. people want to talk to the people who are going to represent them. And like I say to them, how can I represent you best if I've never seen your face, you haven't seen mine, and we don't have a conversation? Yeah. So that's what I've been spending my time doing.
Let me ask you this. Some of the issues that are happening. I mean, there's a strange thing happening in the state of Illinois, and the governor is behind it in the way that Chicago versus the rest of the state. There's Chicago is spending too much. Chicago, with the schools in particular, are getting too much from the state of Illinois. Let's talk about CPS. There's been a lot of rumors about the state taking over Chicago Public Schools, that Chicago Public Schools can be financially insolvent. What's your take on schools and making sure that they're funded appropriately here in the city of Chicago?
Well, first of all, I don't think any of that language that we've heard from the governor regarding bankruptcy and insolvency, I don't think any of that language is helpful. We are not talking about a business or a corporation. We are talking about children and families and the fact that no matter where a child lives, regardless of his or her zip code, that child deserves to have a quality education and to be able to not just matriculate through, you know, high school and hopefully college if that's the choice, but to also just be prepared for the workforce. And that's going to be an issue that's really important for all of us in this state. Whether you have children or not, we need young people who are prepared for the workforce so that they can have opportunities and we can keep our economic engine going. So the state is responsible under our Constitution. The state is responsible for funding our Chicago public schools. I do not believe that they have been adequately funded and that the state is doing its fair share. So I believe that we really have to look at that. And I think we have to also look at accountability within the school system, which is why I also am glad to see that the elected school board legislation is moving forward, because I believe that we have to look at the management of our school system and make sure that they're held accountable. So I think that there's a dual way of looking at that. And I also believe we need more revenue at the state level. And I would support a progressive taxing structure because I really just believe that people who can afford to pay more should pay more.
So, but CPS is practically insolvent at this point. You know, and in fact, there was just a memo that went out to principals saying, hey, don't spend more money. And they can't borrow anymore, and they can't raise taxes. So it looks like CPS is on its way to being taken over by the state one way or another. Should CPS be run by the state? And is Rahm Emanuel doing a good job of running the schools?
I mean, I come back to the fact that we have a governor at this point who has not been able to get a budget passed in this state. So I don't think anybody is looking to him as being the appropriate person to even propose trying to run Chicago Public Schools. We're not seeing that type of management and financial oversight in a way that would anybody would trust. And
how do you put a stop to that?
You know, how
does the legislature stop Governor Bronner from taking over CPS?
Well, I don't think that there's any legal authority for him to do so at this point. So I'm not sure. I would kind of reverse the question. What authority would he have to do it?
Well, he seems to be basically threatening to say, well, I'm going to say that CPS is insolvent.
I hear the threats.
And by doing so, bond markets will no longer lend money to CPS, so it will have to shut down. It's kind of a bank shot, but yeah.
Think we've been seeing with this governor is the desire to kind of see everything just sort of drain out, whether it's struggling families, whether it's senior citizens, whether it's our school system, whatever we're looking at, the approach seems to be we're just going to hold off and just let things kind of just
peter out.
Yeah. And then hopefully everybody will come around and try to push my agenda. I think that that's not a popular agenda, his agenda. I don't think we see support for it. And, like I said, let's get a budget passed. And then you can look at some of the other things that, you know, and try to see where there's room for looking at ideas that might be considered. But at this point, right now, there are families that are struggling. And it's very real. And one of the things, and that's why when I talk to families every day, they're talking about the stuff that's happening in their households. They're really focused on the day-to-day. This is how it's impacting me. And I've talked to mothers, for example, who have said, I quit my job because I don't have child care assistance program anymore. I'm no longer eligible. That's a problem.
So what then do you do? I mean, what we were just talking about here is that Governor Rauner basically has the ability to block anything from happening. And he is saying, we're not going to do anything until I get my turnaround agenda passed. And the state legislature, you know, we don't want to do the turnaround agenda. So what do you do?
Well, it's not just the state legislature. I mean, I think we have to recognize it's the state of Illinois. From what I've conceived from surveys and polling, residents of this state don't want to see this turnaround agenda pushed like he wants to see it. Even if people are supportive of him to some degree, although his popularity is not that high either, people are not looking for that turnaround agenda, and they're certainly not looking at the turnaround agenda as the contingency for getting a budget passed. So again, I would look as a legislator, I would look at any and all ideas that are proposed. But I think right now the main thing is that this governor needs to get a budget passed. We can't continue to see social service organizations laying off their staff, programs being cut, families anxious about how they're going to make it day after day and week after week because of this agenda that is not popular throughout the state of Illinois.
Let me ask you one last question here, just about the district. The 5th District is so it's so diverse.
Sure.
It goes all the way. I mean, we're in the 5th District right here on Michigan Avenue. It goes down to 79th Street. It goes, what, up to the past
about Division and LaSalle division. Or so.
But, mm-hmm. You know, that is the real backbone of the city of Chicago. And there are a lot of people who are affected by social service cuts and a lot of people affected by not having a budget. For you to want to get involved in politics at this juncture or government, it's a tough time for representatives and senators because you have to talk to the people and your hands are tied. This seems to be a battle at the top, leadership versus leadership, moving and shaking and legislators like you or senators or representatives are just considered to be pawns. Why get involved in this and what can you do to change that?
So I'll say two things in response and in closing. I'll first of all say that it's what I've done my entire career. As a mediator and a negotiator, I also teach negotiations at Loyola. The way that I operate is to dive right into places of conflict, find out who needs to be at the table, who are the key stakeholders, what's important to both groups, and to figure out how we can find some points of commonality and to move an agenda forward. That's what I do. So that's a skill set that I want to bring to Springfield, and I know that I can bring on behalf of the people and the residents of the 5th District. But I'll say this as well. I got into this and, you know, I had to circulate my petitions and then I started knocking on doors and starting to have conversation. It has been an education for me to hear from residents. And, I've been motivated day after day to knock on doors hour after hour because I'm listening to people who have felt like they have not had a real voice in this district. I'm listening to people who are saying, you know what, we've had somebody in this office for 13 years. I've never met them. Or I've had somebody in this who's our representative, and now I see him because, you know, he has a lot of money from the Republican sources, and he's now in this contested race, and now he's coming around. But they haven't felt like he's been there all this time. And then you add missing some votes that directly impacts our community and devastates our community. It's just something that I couldn't sit by. So I'm motivated by it because I bring the skill set, but I'm also motivated because I've heard the stories, I've seen the faces, and I've talked to people directly, and I believe they deserve better.
Juliana Stratton is the director of the Center for Public Safety and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she's running for state representative in the 5th District of Illinois. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
This is Chicago's very own 720, WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Mike Fouché, that was a good night. Two good interviews.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And I actually just got a note from the Chicago Board of Elections. As of today, we now have a record number of early votes that have been put in.
There you go.
In Chicago, beating 2008. So
does that favor? Like when you talk about some of the local races,
yeah,
like state's attorney.
You know, I mean,
when you have that much like record, does that matter?
It is pretty big. And actually, what I think is going on is that a number of campaigns are trying to drive in as many votes as they can. You can't really know who they're for, but you certainly can say that there's a lot of interest.
Mike Fouché, AlderTrack.com. He's been here all week, Candidate Week. Mike, thanks for everything.
Wonderful to be here.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. As the primary season ramps up and winds down at the same time, it's looking more and more likely that Secretary Hillary Clinton will be nominee for the Democratic Party in 2016. But that doesn't seem to faze Democrat Rocky De La Fuente. De La Fuente is running as a Democrat in this race, and he hasn't won a state or garnered much attention from the mainstream media. So how do you run for president in 2016? De La Fuente does have one thing, and that's cachet and money. The San Diego real estate tycoon and businessman has his name on a few ballots across the country, including coming up here in Illinois. De La Fuente is a first-generation Hispanic American, and he considers himself a conservative Democrat. Mr. De La Fuente, thanks for being here on The Download. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin, for having me.
Let me start this way, because you're a businessman, San Diego businessman, well-known in California, and you've been involved in politics before. You funded a lot of campaigns. Why run for president?
Let's say simple. I want to pay it forward. America has been very, very good to me, has been very good to my parents. We are very, very good. We do very, very well. And my five children are very well off. I'm very, very proud of them. But our generation lived better than our parents. I don't know if I can say that for you or for your kids. Mm-hmm. We have basically mortgaged our kids' future. Somebody has to change the direction of this country. Nobody knows in which direction we're going because the people at the helm, I don't care if they're Democrats or the Republicans. The Republicans blame the Democrats and the Democrats blame the Republicans. Mm-hmm. But guess what happens? If you have a pothole in front of your house, you don't care who fixes it. You just want the pothole fixed. And I'm here to fix all the potholes.
Well, I mentioned you have a background in politics. Even though you made your money in business and real estate in San Diego, you have been involved in politics. You've funded a lot of campaigns. You've been a delegate for the Democratic Party in the past. Talk about what you know about politics and the way it works and how much experience you've had to get you ready to run for president.
Well, first of all, the United States is the biggest country in the world. You compete in the worldwide arena. You compete against China. You compete against the European Union. So it's no different than having a business. You compete in a worldwide arena. You need to be competitive. You need to know how to advertise. You need to know how to market. You need to know how to compete. You need to know how to bluff. You need to know how to negotiate.
So the same concept that we've been hearing on the Republican side with the businessman Donald Trump is the same concept that can a businessman run the government like a CEO as opposed
to? No question. I would agree to that statement, with exception that Mr. Trump would like to fire people.
Right.
Okay? Now, I believe everybody has everybody can be useful. When he fires them, I'm outside the door. And as he fires them, I hire them because everybody can do something good and something new for this country. You cannot just keep firing people and keep insulting people and get away with it.
You've got two front runners on the Democratic side who are running almost anti-business platforms. You have Senator Sanders who is saying we don't want business, we don't want Wall Street, we don't want anything with business, including government. And you have Hillary Clinton who says I'm a politician, I'm not a business person. Almost all of it is looking at the Republican side because that's really where they're looking at. For you, being in business and making your name and your fortune and everything in business, what's your response to the other people in your party that are vilifying you?
Well, first of all, you need to take a look at the bylaws of the Democratic Party or the bylaws of the Republican Party. They're almost identical. What has happened is through the years or the decades, the Republican Party has gone to the extreme right and the Democrats has gone into the extreme left. And right now, Mr. Trump's support is from the extreme right, 20%, solid. Mrs. Clinton's support is from the extreme left, 20%. What about the rest of us? What about the rest of America? What about the 60%? We never get to make a decision. Well, guess what? This time, the 60% is going to make the decision, and we'll allow some of that 20% extreme right or some of that 20% extreme left to join us.
You consider yourself being more representative of the 60% in the middle. You call yourself a conservative Democrat. What does that mean?
That's what I can call myself, but I also would like to call myself as a responsible Democrat.
Are you more responsible or conservative on social issues, or is it more with fiscal issues? What is it?
Both. For example, to be able to have a good country, you need to have a social net. You cannot abandon the homeless. You cannot abandon the people that they want to go to school. You cannot abandon them because if not, you will have social unrest. So you have to have a 10%, 15%, 20% social net. like Sanders, because you need to have those people. But if you can make him productive and you can make him, everybody would like to be productive. Nobody wants a handout. People would like to just be given the opportunity. So I am social as it relates to the 15% social net. Then what happens on the other end? I've been in sales all my life. I reward my salespeople and I pay them a commission. The more they work, the more they earn. The harder they work, the more they earn. And I don't want to penalize them because they're making money. We currently owe $19 trillion. 19. And that's not counting what's hidden in the closets. We have pensions that we do not know about. We have Social Security we do not know about. My estimate, it's $102 trillion. That's almost $500,000 per every man, woman, and child in this country. What gave them the right to mortgage the future of our children?
Let me ask you this. This is a question. I mean, the more mainstream party Democrats, Secretary Clinton, even Bernie Sanders to an extent, Senator Sanders, have sidestepped really reacting or criticizing President Obama. What's your relationship to President Obama? And as running as a Democrat, how do you feel he did in his eight-year term?
Mr. Obama created a legacy. First African-American. He has come up with a lot of good ideas and a lot of good concepts. Some of them were supported by his party, some were not. But I'm not here to look at what he did or did not do. I'm not going to criticize what the Bush administration did before then. I'm not going to criticize what Nixon did. I'm here to, what do we need to do to go forward, folks? We got a lot of things to go forward. Let me give you an analogy. 1979, Carter went to Iran. And that created a series of events. They created a huge nightmare in those countries, Iran, Iraq, how do you call it, Kurdistan, Syria. Okay, everything there is a mess. It started in 1979. That's 37 years ago. It's going to take me more than 37 days to fix it.
Yeah, right. Rocky De La Fuente is a Democrat running for president of the United States. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about what's not being talked about in the campaign, because, you know, you've got your name on the ballot coming up here in Illinois. You are effectively running for the Democratic nomination. You have the cards stacked against you because you don't have the name recognition or the support of the Democratic Party.
That's a plus.
That's a plus. But we'll talk about it. Let's talk about it. Rocky De La Fuente in studio with me tonight on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Rocky De La Fuente. He's running for president of the United States. I don't have too many presidential candidates that come through here.
Well, hopefully this won't be the first or the last.
That's good.
Maybe next time I'll come as president.
Yeah, that's what you got. That's a promise, right? You'll come in. If you win the if you win the nomination, you got to come back on The Download.
Why don't I invite you to the White House?
Hey, all right. We could do a remote from the White House lawn.
There you go.
All right, let me ask you, you know, one of the issues that's come up on the Democratic side has been the party support. Senator Sanders has talked about how the DNC almost is against him. They're not playing fair. They're behind Secretary Clinton, and they're doing everything they can through caucuses, through primaries, through the support, money, all the stuff to make sure it's Secretary Clinton. From your vantage point as an outside candidate, but running for the Democratic nomination, where do you feel the DNC is at?
I agree 100% with Senator Sanders. I agree 100% with Governor O'Malley.
So you think it's unfair?
Oh, yeah. I believe that that lady should be basically, the other day I basically asked for her resignation. She's to represent the party. She's not representing the party. She's harming the party. She has basically created the less people to show up.
This is Wasserman Schultz, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. She basically is here to represent the party. She was campaign chair in 2008. Well, guess what? When you change from that responsibility to this responsibility, you have ethics, and I don't believe she has any.
And you feel like they have gone out of their way to make sure that people like you or Senator Sanders don't have a chance to upset Secretary Clinton.
Just take a look at when the debates are. They pick the ugliest dates at the worst possible hour so nobody will see. Take a look at what happened. Where's the good candidates? Where's Cuomo? Okay, where's Biden? Well, they were told that they would not get any support from the Democratic Party, so they told them to wait out. And they basically invited basically an independent from Vermont that if he gets elected would be the oldest elected president of the United States.
So even the candidates, the way the candidates were stacked against Secretary Clinton, you believe was rigged and unfair.
We'll take a look at what happened. The Republicans had 17, 18, 19 candidates on debates. There were three business people. There was an African-American. There was a woman. Take a look at that. That was really the big party. Now let's take a look at what happened on the other side, my party. We had the Brown and Black caucus in Iowa. That was supposed to be Willie Wilson from Chicago. He wasn't invited. He's, I think, African-American, if I'm not mistaken. Of course he is. Okay. And I'm the Brown candidate. That forum was created so we would expose our issues. Dr. Wilson has qualified in more than five or six states.
You're saying they had that forum and it was just the main white candidates that were invited?
I only saw two white guys and a girl.
But let me ask you, because it's always a foregone conclusion that black and brown people are going to vote Democratic. That seems like that's what Hillary Clinton is counting on to win the nomination. You see how she's performed well in the South. For you as a first-generation Hispanic American, what is your take on the way that the candidates are courting the Latino vote?
Well, it's not only the Latino vote. It's the minority vote. It's the woman vote. It's the Filipino vote. It's a Hispanic vote because we have a lot of different types of Hispanics.
Yeah.
We have the Mexican-American. We have the people from Central America, Nicaragua, San Salvador, Panama, Costa Rica. We have also the ones from South America. The only ones who don't need any protection are the people from Argentina. Do you know why?
Why?
They have Pope Francis.
Right. That's pretty good, right?
He can protect them.
Right, protect them. Right, right.
But of course, if you happen to be from Argentina and you're this country or you happen to be Democrats abroad, I won't protect everybody. I want to make sure that we run this country with our hearts and our brains.
All right. Do you feel that the Democratic Party is respecting that vote?
They don't care. They only have one objective and one objective only. Wasserman Schultz wants to elect Queen Hillary. And Queen Hillary can't wait to take the day of her coronation.
Let's make a transition to issues, because this is an area where, you know, when we have the Democratic debates, it's Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I mean, they don't really
imagine it's boring.
So let's talk about, because the issues that have played out on the side of, you're starting to see Hillary Clinton spend more time talking about the middle class. You see Senator Sanders talking about finances and the financial world needing regulation because they're ruining the middle class. Those are the issues and seem to be coming up over and over and over when it comes to this year's Democratic crop.
Well, I believe they get older speeches written for them. And I think if the wind is blowing north, they go north. If the wind is blowing south, they go south. And imagine if the electricity goes out, they would not know what to say.
What do you say as a businessman, as a real estate tycoon? What do you say to the idea that Senator Sanders says it's the big banks, it's the financial industry that has ruined America?
He's 100% dead wrong. Okay, he needs to understand that we need to motivate people. Everybody's trying to blame. They're blaming the banks. They're blaming the financial institutions. They're blaming Social Security. They're blaming the Latinos. They're blaming everybody. Folks, let's not blame everybody. Let's roll up our sleeves and let's go to work. Now, how do we get out of this mess? There's only one way and one way only. We need to generate jobs, jobs, and more jobs. We need to grow the country. Now, most small countries will grow at sometimes 5, 6, 7% of gross national product. This is the biggest country in the world. For us to be able to make a dent at that $19 trillion plus all the other hidden liabilities, we're going to need to grow this company a minimum of 4 to 5% gross national product. Mm. Now, that takes vision. That takes savvy.
I like it. You said company instead of country. That's kind of an interesting slip up. But, I mean, it's interesting.
Well, guess what? Let me give you an example. When was the last time we had a World Fair? When was the last time we had the Olympics? When was the last time we had a World Cup? Folks, we need to be marketing. We need to market this country.
Let me ask you about some other issues that the Democrats have brought up and some stuff they haven't. Obviously, crime and, you know, obviously violence in neighborhoods has been a big issue. Police brutality has been an issue here in Chicago. It's playing out in the local election. We're going to see here coming up on the primary. When you see situations like in Ferguson, Missouri, or the case in Eric Garner in New York City, or even here with Laquan McDonald, as a presidential candidate, what's your take on where we're at with civilians and police and security?
You have a basket of apples. One bad apple spoils the rest. We have bad apples in government. We also have good apples. We have good apples in the police force, but we also have bad apples. And what we normally try to do is talk about the bad apples. We need to weed out the bad apples, and everybody knows who they are. Unfortunately, if you're a bad teacher, by the way, I love teachers. The majority, almost all of them, 99% are good teachers. But the one bad teacher, why doesn't he get fired? the one bad policeman. Why can nobody get fire him? The judges, federal judges, are appointed for life. 99.99% of the federal judges are very good judges. But I know a couple of them that, honest to God, I would not let him take care of my dog. Okay? And the question is, just like we were able to impeach President Nixon, the same thing is going to happen to Hillary for what she's doing in this campaign. And what Wasserman Schultz is doing, she's going to go to jail. And maybe she might have a cellmate.
Let me ask you this as we wrap up. What's success for you in this campaign?
This is a 50-mile race. Why 50? We have 50 states. Of course, we have the 6th territory. But let's leave this as, well, 56 miles for our public. 56 miles. Okay. Iowa, mile one. New Hampshire, mile two. Nevada, mile three. South Carolina, mile four. Folks, you do not win a marathon in the early stages. Yes, you might have some front runners. What's important is who crosses the finish line.
But you have a lot of, I mean, you see even in the, on the Democrat side, Mr. O'Malley, on the Republican side, Jeb Bush, governor, former Governor Bush. I mean, there have been people who have already said, this is unwinnable for me. I take my bow. Thank you very much. Okay. I tried to be president. What keeps you in the race?
Very simple. Mr. O'Malley was the third candidate, and he was not getting any traction. He was not getting any traction, even though he was allowed to basically participate in all the debates. I was not. Okay? And what did they do in Nevada? What did they do in Iowa? They took me out of the caucus. They took me 4 days before the caucus. They decided that I was a threat to the Democratic Party and to Queen Hillary. And they put me as other. Folks, I had qualified. I was there. How dare they tell me I become other? That's unfair to the American people.
Democratic candidate Rocky De La Fuente, he's on the ballot here in Illinois for March
15th. And more than 40 others.
He's running for the nomination on the Democratic side. Mr. De La Fuente, thanks for talking with us tonight, and good luck with the campaign.
Justin, you're a gentleman and a scholar.
Man, that was a good 2 hours straight of politics. We did it. We did it. What a week. So many great stories happening, you know, at the primary coming up next Tuesday. But it's not all that's happening in Chicago. So we're going to pivot away from politics. And I wish we could do more. We're actually going to be hosting election night on Tuesday night. So tune in here, WGN 720. As Duffy says, nobody does 2016 like 720. I love that. Here on the download, we've been experimenting with a regular segment. We're kind of soft launching called Highbrow. It's the download's look at the fine arts. We may do it weekly because, I mean, there's so much to talk about. It's amazing how much world-class art happens here in the city of Chicago, and we have this great outlet to talk about it. It's conversations, performances, and interviews from Chicago's great arts and culture scene, but not in a hoity-toity kind of way, you know, because I'm not that familiar with concertos or librettos, but I'm not intimidated by it. I'm curious, so forgive me if I say the wrong things. Let's start right there, right? That's where we get start. But tonight, we bring you a little bit of the symphony. We bring you a little bit of the opera and a little bit of the theater and two maracas. Well, welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up in the next couple days, the Chicago Sinfonietta is presenting a new show called BYOB. No, it's not symphony and a bottle of wine from home. BYOB stands for Bring Your Own Beat. It's work that features the percussion, which in my eyes is mostly overlooked when it comes to the symphony. Those woodwinds get all the attention in the front. And the kicker is that the Chicago Sinfonietta wants you to bring your own drum, anything to bang on. The shows are this Saturday night at Wentz Hall in Naperville, and then on Monday night downtown at Symphony Center. One of the performers is here with me in studio. Alcides Rodriguez is with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, and he'll be performing with the piece Maracas Concerto, in which he features his world-renowned maracas. Alcides, welcome to the download.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. How often do you get to Chicago?
Not so often, you know. Like I went to school here, and I graduated from Northwestern back in 2003. And I actually haven't been back to Evanston since I graduated, wow. So I might just give it a visit this week.
There you go.
So, yeah, I'm excited to be back here.
Let me ask you, you know, I said it in the intro right there that I feel like the percussions sometimes are left behind when you think of the symphony. You think of the violins or maybe you think of the clarinets or even the cellos. But yeah. The percussions, they sort of are always in the back, literally.
Yeah.
Talk about the relationship between percussive instruments and the symphony.
Yeah. Well, you know, the percussion, I think, is a very important section of the symphony because they add, they keep the orchestra together, you know, by keeping the rhythm, you know, going. But more than rhythm, I think percussion adds a lot of colors, you know, into the orchestral spectrum. And obviously, the better the orchestra, the less you should feel the percussion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, their job is to blend in.
Right.
And just sometimes, you know, like if we hear something very special and we hear like a bass drum going in the bottom, you know, we hear these nice, low sounds that's mixing with the basses and the cellos. But we don't know that the bass drum is playing, but, you know, that is present there. Sometimes, you know, if you use a triangle, you know, playing with the violins or the snare mm-hmm. drums, and all the instruments add like a nice color to what's going on in the orchestra. So what you hear is the result of all the sounds blended.
What's a usual percussion or percussive instrument that would be featured in a symphony?
Let's say the kettle drum or the timpanis, you know, come back from the classical period. But, you know, besides the timpanis, you know, we have the snare drums, we have the triangle, we have the xylophones, you know, which is part of the string, the keyboard instruments. So those are the most obvious instruments in the orchestra.
I noticed that you didn't mention maracas.
Yeah.
Seems to be your instrument. That's why you're here tonight.
Well, actually, the maracas are used not so often because it's a relatively new instrument. It's basically an instrument that is mostly part of the Latin American tradition, you know, like Cuban music, mostly in salsa. And in Venezuela, it's huge because it's part of the traditional ensemble of traditional music of Venezuela. So that's how I became so familiar with the maracas because I grew up listening to that sound.
That's a great way to put it because when I think of the maracas, I do think of a more casual setting, music around the house, maybe more traditional folk kind of music.
Yeah.
But I don't ever think of the maracas with the symphony. How do you blend them together?
Yeah, well, it's only a few composers like, you know, George Gershwin and Bernstein have used maracas. You know, in pieces like, for example, Gershwin uses on his famous piece called the Cuban Overture, because, you know, it's Cuban. You know, So he uses the maracas there, and Bernstein also uses the maracas in a West Side Story.
Uh-huh.
So because it's all, you know, associated with Puerto Rico and Latin mm-hmm. American music. But other than that, the maracas is not used very much, you know, except for a lot of Latin composers that are starting to using it more and more.
Do you find that, I mean, it's the idea of using traditional folk music like maracas or folk instruments, that you're finding it moving out of just Latin American composers or Latin American music and being used in sort of crossovers to...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because I guess when a composer start, you know, discovering the sounds that those instruments make and they get really interested about. And the thing is, you know, sometimes, for example, with the maracas, you can do rhythms that can be done with a snare drum too. So you can basically substitute. So then it becomes an issue of preference or colors, and the composer might want to use a maracas instead of a snare drum, you know. Another instrument that is very popular now is the cajon, which is, it comes from the Peruvian region, you know. And it's also sometimes used instead of a snare drum.
Okay.
And sometimes instead of the maracas, actually in the Venezuelan music. So it's also becoming very, very popular.
So some of the more indigenous instruments are replacing mm-hmm. snare drums and timpanis and other things like
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
So talk about the concerto you're going to do this week, Saturday and Monday. You're performing as part of it. Talk about what we should expect from this performance.
The concerto for maracas, you know, every time I talk to people about, you know, concerto for maracas, it sounds kind of odd because it's like the maracas, they don't play melody, you know, it's just rhythm. But what is very interesting about this concerto is, first of all, I'm standing in the front of the orchestra, and I think big part of it is visual too, about all the choreography, all these things I do with my hands and, you know, and shaking the maracas. That's also a cool part of the concerto. Yeah. But musically, I mean, I think the orchestration is very brilliant, you know. And that's what, you know, it gives the whole concerto the you know, the final product, you know. Like, and I think the orchestral part is very difficult too. And when you add the maracas to it, then everything makes sense, you know.
Well, the concerto will be on stage on Saturday at Wentz Hall in Naperville and Monday at the Symphony Center as part of the Chicago Sinfonietta show, BYOB, Bring Your Own Beat. Now, I see you got your maracas out here.
Yeah.
What's special about these? Are these, like, custom-made for you, or did you pick these up at, like, the folks music store?
No, these are actually traditional Venezuelan maracas, and they are actually made in Venezuela, and actually, these ones are very famous. You know, the person that makes these maracas is known in the whole world for making these maracas.
Wow.
And I actually didn't know he lived in my hometown until I came to the United States. And I started finding out about these maracas. And then I found out that the guy lives in my hometown.
Where's your hometown?
It's a small town. It's called Guanare. And it's in the Plain region in Venezuela.
And so you're seeing all this, like, it's coming from there, and you're like, hey, I was a block away from there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, you know, the next time I went back to Venezuela, after I find out, I just, you know, contacted him, and he's the most humble guy, super nice, and, you know, he showed me a bunch of maracas. He showed me, you know, the first, you know, basically the basics about playing maracas, and that's how I really got into it. And we have become friends. He's in late 70s now, but his maracas are known all around the world. I mean, this is pretty amazing.
All right, let's hear some of this.
Yeah. So let's see. I'm gonna get a little bit away from this because these are loud.
It's loud. Okay.
But so basically the maracas, you know, you can just shake them. You know, this is the kind of sound you make with it. So you can, you know, rattle like.
That's great.
Yeah.
I have limited maracas experience.
Yeah.
I don't remember ever doing anything like that. I would go, just those in the background and try to keep up with the beat. So BYOB, Bring Your Own Beat. You want people to bring percussive instruments to this. I mean, do you want it to be anything special or anything that you can really bang on?
Basically anything you can bang in, you know, and that's the amazing thing about percussion, you know, and you know, the percussion is in the professional orchestras, you know, like, you know, the Chicago Symphony, the Atlanta Symphony, are highly trained musicians, you know, and sometimes, you know, and I really have a lot of respect, you know, for the percussionists because, you know, I am a clarinetist, you know, that's what my career is based on, you know, I just play maracas on the side, you know, because it's part of, you know, I grew up with that. But, you know, as a clarinetist, I just focus on one thing, you know, on the clarinet. Whereas, you know, the percussionists, you know, they have so many instruments. Basically, anything you can hit could be a percussion instrument.
Right.
You know,
right.
And sometimes composers use, you know, like a brake drums, you know, from a car. You know, they use an anvil. You know, they use anything that this sounds great. Let's use this. You know, and most people might think that it's just, you know, it's just about hitting it. You know, but it's not just about hitting. It's how you hit it. You know, and how you can make it sound great. And that's the amazing thing about percussionists, you know, like especially the highly trained ones, that they know how to, you know, make music actually with this instrument. So, and that's, I think that's the fun part of this, you know, this concert, that, you know, bringing whatever you can hit, you know.
Well, it's also the community, right?
Exactly.
I mean, just the idea that everybody together is not only watching the symphony, but being a part of it. That's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, you know, trying to make something together and just having all these sounds mixed, you know. It's great. I just walked past, you know, in a corner here. Like, there was a group of like five musicians, you know, just, and the guy was playing instead of a drum set, he had, you know, just tops, you know, and he sounded great. It was awesome, you know. So it's like,
I hope you're referring to the Bucket Boys in town because you should bring. I'll see this. You should go find the Bucket Boys right now, Michigan Avenue, if you want to see
I've
how
seen,
Chicago
I've seen
does.
It before.
Yeah, how
I've
Chicago
seen it before,
does percussion. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah,
that's pretty good. Alcides Rodriguez is with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah,
he's a maracas player. He's also a clarinetist, and he will be performing as part of the Concerto for Maracas at the BYOB show, which is Bring Your Own Beat,
as part of the Chicago Sinfonietta. It will be at Wentz Hall in Naperville on Saturday, and that's going to be at the Chicago Symphony Center on Monday. Are you excited to play that room?
Oh, I'm so looking forward to it. It's like, you know, it's for, I think for any musician, just playing in that room is just amazing, you know. Just for me, it's like this is the Chicago Symphony, you know, hall, so I'm going to be just standing up right there, so...
There you go. Well, Alcides, yeah, thanks so much for coming in and playing the maracas. And,
oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Have a great show.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, did you see the Danny Trevathan press conference today, the new Bears linebacker, where he backtracked, he backpedaled on whether or not he said the Denver Bronco defense was better than the 85 Bears defense, right?
Yeah.
That's what he said. And then in the presser today, he backpedaled like, well, you know, I wasn't there in 85. It's a special group of guys, like the whole thing. I missed this story today. I guess he talked to NFL Network today, and he said the headline is on CBS Sports and says, new Bears linebacker Danny Trevathan, I wish the Packers would have called me. I guess he told NFL Network that he's buddies with Randall Cobb, and he wished that the Packers would have called in free agency, but they didn't, so I'm here in Chicago.
If you are a newly minted Bear, the two things you don't want to say is that you have a better defense than the 85 Bears and that you wish the Packers would have called you. Those are probably about the two dumbest things you could possibly say.
I'm like, what else could
Welcome
this guy
to Chicago.
Say? Welcome to Chicago.
Right, yeah. I bet you his jerseys will be flying off the shelves.
That's amazing. I mean, he's got to have agents and stuff. They're like the Lovie Smith playbook, beat the Packers. Win the division, beat the Packers. And you're like, all right, yeah. I like this guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and where are the Bears handlers, too? Like, dude,
yeah,
dude,
right.
You know, like in the back of the room, cut it off. Don't say that.
Anyway, wow. That's amazing.
Dummy.
All right, well, let's get back to Highbrow here. It's our regular segment that we're experimenting with here on the download. It's where we look at the fine arts, so we'll get past Trevathan and the Bears and get back to fine arts. We may do it weekly. I like it, and there's enough content. That's the thing. There's enough to talk about. Conversations, performances, interviews from Chicago's great arts and culture scene, but not in that sort of, oh, hello, like erudite kind of way. I don't know a lot about this stuff. I'm learning, you know, with you, the listener, and I will try. But I'm not intimidated by it by any stretch. I'm curious about it. So that's how we're going to do it here. Our next segment's on the opera, Der Rosenkavalier, which is a 110-year-old romantic. It's a rom-com. For the opera. Welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the current show at the Lyric is a romantic comedy that boasts not only double crosses, but how about double cross-dressing? And who said the opera couldn't have attitude, right? The 100-year-old romantic comedy Der Rosenkavalier is on stage at the Lyric through March 13th. The opera stars Amanda Majeski, a soprano who's in her second lead role this season after Marriage of Figaro this past fall. Majeski has performed all over the world and will be back on stage in Figaro at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. It's coming up here. Majeski grew up in Gurnee. She did some of her schooling at the Lyric, and she got her first lead role at the Chicago Opera Theater. Amanda Majeski is homegrown opera, and she joins me tonight on the download. Amanda, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about this because, you know, I've had a couple of people who've been involved in the Lyric and the opera, and they don't necessarily come from Chicago or more specifically from the Chicago suburbs. How'd you get involved in it?
Well, you know, I had a wonderful set of parents who just exposed me to everything when I was growing up. You know, I played every sport. They had me in piano. They had me in dance. And I just kind of gravitated towards the artistic side. When I was in high school, I danced quite a bit. And I thought, well, what kind of goes with dance? Choir kind of goes with dance. And so I signed up for the choir and I tried to audition for the variety show that my high school performed and didn't get in.
What?
It's okay because it
letter campaign.
Yeah, well, it led me to take some voice lessons. I said to my mother, you know, maybe I need to work on my voice a little bit. So found a wonderful teacher who brought out some classical art song books, and I said, well, what I'd rather sing Rent or Les Mis or something like that.
Right.
But the more I studied, the more I loved it and kept on. And
when you're studying like that, when you're studying for voice and you say the classical arts, is it always pushed towards opera? Is that the idea that when you're learning how to sing that you're going to go in that direction? Because it seems like that would be at the top end of singing.
Sure, sure. It's not always the case. When I was studying first, my teacher seemed to notice that I had a stronger head voice and I couldn't belt for anything. and so that kind of just naturally led me towards the classical repertoire. But it's different for everybody.
Yeah. Well, let's start. When was the moment where you're like, okay, I've taken these lessons. I've learned a little bit. What drew you to opera?
Actually, it was going to Lyric. I didn't know much about opera when I started out, but I started out at Northwestern University for my undergraduate degree, and I felt pretty behind my classmates because I just didn't know very much about it. I knew more about the musical theater side. So I was encouraged.
So a lot of classmates were already in.
Oh, yes. A lot of my classmates knew that they wanted to be opera singers from the age of five. That was not my experience. So to gain a little bit more experience, I went to Lyric and I saw almost the entire season, I think, that my freshman year, and just really fell in love with the art form, especially with Carlisle Floyd's Susanna that they did that season. I was just blown away. I didn't know that opera could be so powerful. And so I became really, really interested in exploring that for myself.
So at what point do you realize you're at Northwestern that opera's for you? I mean, you have on your resume that you trained at the Lyric. The Lyric has it. What's it called? The Ryan?
The Ryan Opera Center. Yeah. It's a young artist training program. Yeah, right before you go out into the world as a professional. They have a wonderful program to kind of get you ready.
Well, talk about that program. What about it? What did you know about going in, and what did it teach you going through it?
Well, I always had it on my mind because, ever since I was going to the Lyric, I would see these young faces in the program that had these incredible voices, and I would see Loca next to their name, which was the name of the Ryan Opera Center at the time. And so when I was studying, I said, oh man, if I could just get into that group, if I could be good enough to get into that group, I would have totally made it. And so I always had my sights set on that goal. And once I got into the program, it was really incredible, the training. You work with wonderful vocal coaches, vocal teachers. They give you the opportunity to perform smaller roles and to understudy large roles. And then they trust you enough where if the singer who's scheduled to sing is indisposed for some reason, they put you on
really?
Stage. And that actually happened to me in my first year in the program. I was covering understudying The Marriage of Figaro, and the singer was indisposed, and so that's how I got my first opportunity to go on with the role.
What do you remember about that? I mean, did they give you a call like, Amanda, hey, we got to talk
to you?
Yeah,
the night before, which is actually a luxury in opera. You know, sometimes you get the call the day of. So I had a little bit of time to prepare and got to try on the costume and work with the conductor just a little bit, but it was a whirlwind experience and actually one of the most incredible moments I've had on stage. I don't have much of a memory of it, to be honest, other than I just found it completely exhilarating. I loved it.
So after going through the training, what's next for you? I mean, they say, okay, it's ready to be a professional. And what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that you're in the cycle of different, you know, singers that are going to be on different stages around the world? Is it just like you get your official card? You're now allowed in any stage,
in any
place? How does it work?
Well, for me, it worked in that while during my time in the Ryan Center, I also connected with an agent. And that agent sent me out on every audition imaginable. And luckily, actually, the Ryan Center brings people to you, so you get that opportunity to audition as well. So I did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of auditions.
Let me ask about an opera audition.
Sure.
You know, because I'm familiar with acting auditions and going in the room. But, I mean, is it just pretty much belting it out in front of three people who are at a table, and
it
they're like,
pretty much
you.
Is.
Next.
It looks kind of like American Idol, except with the piano. I hate to say it, but, you walk in and you pick your first piece, and there are usually three or four people sitting at a table, like you said. You sing your first piece, and then they choose the second piece.
Really?
And that's pretty standard, I think, across the board. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm just fascinated. I know nothing about the inner workings of how you land a job in opera. And you, of course, you're highly decorated in the way that you're doing shows at the Lyric Opera. And the next show, it's just a little thing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City.
Deal.
No big deal. But is it cutthroat-like acting where, you know, there always are 100 people in for one role or 200 people? I mean, is there a huge competition for roles in opera?
Well, sure. I mean, I think, there are several sopranos, that are out there trying to succeed in the business. And, it is competitive, but it's only cutthroat, I think, if you let it be cutthroat. You know, for me, I know my voice is unique and it's not the same as somebody else. And that could mean that I'm right for the part, and it could not mean that I'm right for the part.
You feel like you have a unique soprano.
I would say, but I think every singer does. Every singer has something unique that they bring to it. And so when you focus on that as opposed to comparing yourself to someone else.
Is there a way to put that into words? Like what makes your voice unique?
Oh,
you know what
oh
I mean?
Gosh.
I could never do that. That's a hard thing. I understand it. Like, but what is it that you think that when you're going in and you've had that competitive edge, what is it about your voice that you feel?
I know for me, I love to connect to the text of the piece. I think that's something maybe that I can bring to the table is coloring a phrase to bring out the meaning of the text and to bring out emotion in the music and also to give that to the audience. I don't know.
I thought maybe you would like curl your R's or something.
Oh, well, we all do that.
Yeah, we all do
that.
Right. Talking with Amanda Majeski. She's from Gurney, but she is a critically acclaimed opera singer, soprano. She's on the Lyric stage right now with the comedy Der Rosenkavalier till March 13th. Talk about, do you have a preference as a singer to work in comedy or work in drama or different kinds of opera?
Oh, I like playing the crazy women. Yeah. Well, that's always really, really fun to play, to try to kind of just let yourself go in the role. But, you know, it's wonderful to play that emotional character, too.
Let me ask you, what drew you to this, to Der Rosenkavalier? I mean, what is it about this opera that you can sink your teeth into?
Oh, well, first, the music is just the best music that there is, in my opinion. I think it's absolutely beautiful and incredible. I'm so lucky that my character gets to sing a lot of it. That and the Marshaline is a completely complex character. She's in love with Octavian, and she realizes throughout the course of the piece that they're just in different places in their lives, and she has to be the bigger person and let him go so that he can live his life the way he should. And her coming to terms with that decision is really fascinating.
Now, you had a lead in Marriage of Figaro, which was at the Lyric in the fall, and then you're doing Figaro again coming up here at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Are there certain texts or certain operas that you gravitate to that you're like, oh, I got to be in Figaro again? I mean, do you become like a Figaro expert?
Well, I've done now, I believe, 7 or 8 productions of Figaro, and you know, that's the hardest role that I sing, but it seems to follow me around quite frequently.
So people see you and they're like, ah, she got it.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. But I also tend to choose roles based on what I think is right for my voice in the moment. And that one just seems to
What is it about that role that you feel you keep coming back to?
Well, I love the character. I think she's going through a really tough time in life, but she continues on with hope and with strength, which I really, really, really like about her. And also, I mean, to be able to sing Mozart ensembles with a cast that comes together, there's nothing better, I think.
That's great. Let me ask you this question just about the opera. I mean, it's funny because I lived in a little apartment in New York City, and there was a opera singer who lived next door.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's and I just remember, and it wasn't a long time. I was just, as I guess creative people do, you just find yourself living in an apartment for 3 weeks, and then you're on your way to something else.
Oh,
but
sure.
But every day, this guy would just belt out. I mean, it was like it would ring the whole apartment, you know, and all the whole block. But it was fascinating to me because it's like, this is like his warm-up. This is what he has to do. I mean, is that what you have to do as an opera singer?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to get into your singing room and essentially practice?
Oh, yes. Well, I hope that he kept it between the hours of 9 a.m. and 8 p.m.
Right.
But yes, we do, you know, you have to warm up the voice before you sing. That's
so
essential.
You're doing it all day. I mean, talk about that instrument, because this is obviously opera without microphones, the whole bit.
Yeah.
Like, what is it to keep that voice strong?
Well, it's not the same thing as, say, a violinist who will go into the practice room and practice for hours upon hours upon hours. You know, we have to be careful, you know, it's just little muscles in the voice, in the throat, and you know, you have to be careful not to overdo it. So, you know, I'd say a good healthy warm-up for me is about 30 minutes, and then just kind of pacing yourself throughout the day, not overdoing it, but you know, getting some good practicing in every day, at least for about an hour a day. And then, you know, there are a lot of things that a singer can do that doesn't involve using the voice, you know, translating the score, you know, looking at the music, you know, going over your text, that sort of thing.
Now, as a professional opera singer, I mean, what what do you do to protect your voice? I mean, this is your instrument. This is your livelihood.
Yeah.
You know, there's the singers on a rock stage who, you know, go out and...
Must be nice, right?
Rock and roll, and they're on the next day, and they're like, yeah, but that's a different kind of thing than what you have to do. How do you protect your voice?
I definitely avoid loud restaurants, loud bars, anywhere where I have to talk over somebody. I find talking to be a lot more straining than singing. So, you know, I avoid talking on the phone for long hours. And then I avoid certain foods that are spicy or acidic, that sort of thing. And I try not to eat too late because that sort of acid reflux can sometimes burn the vocal cords if you're not careful.
So going back to Gurney, I mean, how often do you go back and do people recognize your accomplishments as, you know, as a world-class opera singer?
Well, my parents still live there.
Okay, good.
So I do.
So they put the clippings up on the window.
They're pretty proud, yeah. They get really excited. People in my mom and dad's offices always come up to them with, you know, this article
we
or
saw
that
this.
Article
right,
or something
right,
like
right.
that. So, yeah, you know, I loved growing up there and always feel like it's home in a way.
Well, Amanda Majeski is on stage until March 13th with the 100-year-old plus, it was 1911, romantic comedy Der Rosenkavalier. She's a soprano. She's going to be back on stage with Marriage of Figaro in the spring at Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Amanda, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us tonight, and good luck with your career.
Thank you so much.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Reminding you that we're off tomorrow night. And we will be off again on Monday night. They rarely have. It's a long weekend. Pete, I think we got a four-day.
St. Patrick's Day weekend, buddy. Green beer.
Yeah, we definitely have to make something happen there. And I should take advantage. I mean, come on. You know, I'm all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
You're a parade guy?
I am a parade guy. I mean, in theory. Mm-hmm. I don't know the last time I've been to a parade. I did the Halloween parade. You know, they had like a little parade downtown.
Like up on Halstead?
No, they had a Halloween parade. That's the gay pride parade. That's not Halloween.
No, they have one for Halloween, too.
No. They had like a little thing like, I don't know. I couldn't tell you anything beyond the idea that
I recommend to go to the one on Halstead. It's memorable.
So I guess 4 day. No, we'll still be working though, because Pete and I are in charge, and we are going to execute election night coverage for WGN Radio on Tuesday night.
How about that?
So we are going to be doing the 7 to 11. The show, the download will be. We won't call it the download. We'll just call it WGN Election Special. But we're going to have all sorts of people. That's what tomorrow and Monday. I mean, it's amazing the lineup that we've had just in the Iowa caucuses and the Super Tuesday. But the people that are going to call in, the people that are going to be in studio with us, I mean, it's going to be a great night.
Can't wait.
I don't know how we're going to fit it all.
Yeah.
It's always the problem, you know?
Yeah.
And like Super Tuesday, which threw us off. I'll be honest. It threw me off that Bernie Sanders did his speech at 6:30, he did it at 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
Who does either a concession or a victory speech at 6:30?
Yeah, you think they want to get in front of? I mean, maybe with the cable news, it doesn't matter. It used to be like, you know, get it for the 10 o'clock news. I know that'll probably happen locally here with some of the big races and Anita Alvarez and Kim Fox and Donna Moore and such. But now I guess it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly. So To be honest, I feel like that will be, I mean, that kind of threw me off because Hillary Clinton went at 7:30 that night. Anyway, that won't happen here in Illinois on Tuesday night. So we'll be here, as we said many a times, nobody does 2016 like 7:20. Okay, you know what we're going to do? We'll take a break. We come back. Chris Jones is here. We're going to talk theater as we wrap up Highbrow tonight. Stay with us. You go to Leela Arts Center, you go to the Goodman Theater and get a ticket for $173. Wow. Chris Jones' story today in the Chicago Tribune, chief theater critic for the paper, is here in studio. Good to see you.
Always nice to be here on the download.
So, yeah, I mean, I saw that and I was like, okay, so maybe this is like a VIP thing where it's at the top, but it's really not. This is a trend that more and more theaters are moving towards. That
well, it's
Broadway
the you know it's something called dynamic pricing or variable pricing, which is when the price of the ticket shifts according to demand. You know, the Cubs do it. The Cubs are doing it more and more this year. Walt Disney World does it. So the thinking goes, why not your local friendly nonprofit theater when you have a big hit? Why not, you know, for those people who've procrastinated, didn't buy a subscription, shame on them. They can only go on a Saturday night. Why don't you say, look, if you want a really good seat, it's going to cost you. Their argument, which they've made vociferously today to me, as you can imagine, is that many arguments. One is that the money goes back into new work. They say if we didn't do shows like this, we couldn't do the really cool stuff we do.
This is for War Paint.
This is for War Paint. This is with Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. It's about the cosmetic wars, with Helena Rubinstein. And it's a show that a lot of people want to see. And in fact, in fairness to the Goodman, the reason you know those prices are so high is very few tickets are left. So, you know, after they, I'm holding the phone about 300 yards from my ear today, but that was the end of it. I'm like, you're going to sell a lot of tickets because people are going to read this column and they're going to go, wow, this is a hot show. And they're going to snap up all the cheaper seats.
Right.
So I think the Goodman will be just fine. But it does bring up this issue of should there be a ceiling for a nonprofit,
right?
Like, should they charge whatever the market should bear? It's a good question, and I see both sides.
Well,
of the
argument. Broadway has had hits like Hamilton. Yeah. We just talked about Hamilton coming here. They don't care. They're going to trip.
Well, Hamilton, if you want to see, right? If you like, just say Justin Camp. Well, you of course would have all your entree. They'd be laying out.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend you'd be a regular punter. Let's not make that pretense. But for the average listener, if you wanted to see Hamilton like next week, you'd be dropping $400 or $500 a ticket if you could get one.
Wow.
Even if you now, if you want to buy the more regular prices, you're looking a year out, you know, and you're still looking at close to $200. The question will be here in Chicago, where I like to think we're a bit more sane than New York. Like, I loved Hamilton in New York. I'm like, would I give up a kidney for this show? No, it's a good show. It's a really good show, but you know, people say to me, is it worth
thing,
like,
right?
I guess it depends how much $1,000 is to you. But I do think we will see when Hamilton arrives, we will see some serious prices.
Is this a trend? I mean, the Goodman Theater can do this because they got a big show coming in, but there are other big shows, the Chicago Shakespeare, Steppenwolf. Are we going to see dynamic pricing and the idea of higher ticket when you got a hit, you're going to see harder to get tickets and more expensive for something like
and maybe cheaper tickets when they can't sell a ticket to save their lives, right? Which is sort of very similar to how hotels are priced. I was in New York this weekend seeing Blackbird with Michelle Williams. I stayed at a very nice hotel. Lovely. I stayed at the beautiful Waldorf Astoria for a very cheap price because it's March. So, you know, you can stay at a very nice place. So it's the same principle as that. But the difference is that nonprofits are mission-based and they have various advantages based on the fact that they serve the community.
Right.
They argue they serve it just fine by doing this. Fair enough. Hear the argument. But, you know, if you want to see that show, I'm like, well, would you charge $275? $300? $400? $500? Is there
it's just amazing to, I mean, just thinking about it, you're like, wow, that's just so much money. But again, it is 2016, and it seems Hamilton.
I went with a friend of mine last night to the lovely Prime and Provision over there, and I'm looking at that menu, and I'm thinking, it's hard to get out of here for less than a couple of hundred ahead. It is hard on that menu, you know, it is.
Yeah.
It is not, you know.
It's downtown. I mean, if you're looking for a theater experience that's, you know, like me, maybe $7. It's not going to be downtown.
No, and you can do well if you, you know, a lot of people who listen to your show are sophisticated consumers of the theater. They know how to get their gold star. They know how to get their hot ticks. Show they got that ancient student ID. They truck that out. That works for them from time to time. So, but you know, you got to represent the, you know, Justin, the regular folks.
Well, there's something to the idea that Chicago is a staging ground or like the pre for Broadway.
Right,
so
the
reason that is because you want to connect to a regular audience. You want to connect to a different. So charging the same level of price defeats the purpose a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I like to think that Chicago is a little more sane and we're all reasonable people. We all calm down. Let's not get too carried away. You know, we don't have, you know, the great income inequality is here in America. Maybe a little, here in Chicago, a little more. Aren't we? Aren't we? Yeah. Compared to New York or LA, aren't we a little more
a little,
in
the
middle?
We're supposed to be.
Aren't
yeah.
we?
We're supposed
so,
to
So, you know, I like to think now and again, you got to hold. You got to, you know, you got to say, come on, guys, come on.
All right, let's switch gears. The one thing I was just talking to Rob Martyr about this. I saw the Steppenwolf, you know, they announced their season.
New
Everybody's
season.
Doing seasons.
Yes.
I'm so confused when a season begins and when a season ends. I thought we got rid of that. I thought the idea was that there's shows in the summer, there's shows. And I'm seeing all these previews. These are all for the start in the fall?
They're mostly for the start in the fall. Here is the interesting thing, right? So your millennials, those millennials out there right now listening to you, the millennials, yeah. mysterious millennials, they don't like, the theory goes, to buy season subscriptions. You've got to plan ahead. You've got to plunk down your cash in advance. So a lot of theaters, and Steppenwolf's trying to do this, are moving more to like memberships, Netflix for the stage. The Theater Wit does that on the north side.
Okay.
So the idea is you get a card and you can take four, Justin Kaufman and three of his best friends to this show and not bother with the next one. It's all very flexible and it's the way of the future. Everyone thinks that's where the puck is going, but they still have these subscription bases in some cases, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 people, and they can't get rid of it because if they did that,
it's a lifeline.
A lifeline.
Yeah, right.
It's not so different, really, from our fabulous world of media where, you know, you've got, oh, the digital world is where it's going, but hey, that paper's a lot of subscribers. You know, let's not forget.
We are on 720 AM.
Yes, we are. WGN, yeah. Let me say, well, the N in newspaper. So that's a bit of an analogy.
Yeah, that's a good
point. It's a bit of an analogy, but I think.
So the seasons are really for subscriptions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I think most of the actual artists find them a big pain in the neck because they get locked into things. The other thing that's happened at Steppenwolf is those big stars who you want to see, I want to see, everyone wants to see, the big names, they're all on TV shows. They would love to come to Chicago and do 2 or 3 weeks on this, a weekend here, but they cannot and will not sit down for the kind of money they're making at Steppenwolf for like 12 weeks when they could be, you know, on a TV show.
And they got to make that decision
and
so
got,
far in
right,
advance,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's the other thing. You got to commit out and you don't know what you're going to do. Then they announce it and we do a big story. And then they're like, oh, Laurie Metcalf, not happening. So then, so that's the dilemma they're in. And I sympathize. I don't sympathize that much, but I sympathize a little.
Well, Steppenwolf
it's
being one,
stories.
I mean, they got some big shows. The Tracy Letts show.
Well, he's huge right now. Right. Carrie Coon, you know, is in that. The Mary Page Marlowe is going to be very big. We got some big shows. We've got Mary Page Marlowe. We've got SpongeBob SquarePants. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Let's not underestimate the appeal of your SpongeBob SquarePants coming your way this summer.
You say that so
I
elegantly.
Like it.
Yeah,
SpongeBob SquarePants. And of course, Hamilton, that little show called Hamilton, where people in where I work, people who've never even heard of the word theater, they go, theater? What? Who are you again? You're not worth anything. Wait, can I get tickets to Hamilton? There's a show called Hamilton?
Go over to Jones has got some tickets.
He's all right. We'll keep him around another month. Why not? He could get us into Hamilton. That's cool.
Your new boss is at the train.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, we'll
yeah.
go to Hamilton. Jones
That's
will get
cool.
us Well, it's not just the Steppenwolf because I've seen other, you know, here come the announcement for the season. I mean, is there any trend to pull from what has been announced for the new seasons? Does Chicago have like a next year is going to be daring or innovative? Is there going to be a specific kind of theater that we should expect in 2016-2017?
Well, I think you're seeing a bit of a generational shift in a few theaters. I mean, Steppenwolf, if I have a look at that Steppenwolf season, I would say it's a very downtown season in the New York sense of downtown. There's Taylor Mack, who's a very well-known performance artist, sort of writer, conceptualist, New York, Young John Lee, who's the same, very, very trendy. What we would have thought of 10 years ago as something you would find more in a fringy gallery kind of space, now they're very mainstream. Mm. And of course, those artists have become older and become more mainstream as they've gone on in their careers. But I would say that you're getting a little more of a mix and match. Hey, there's a little show here. A bit away from the, you know, it's Friday night, we're opening one of our five shows this year. So that is the trend. But, you know, it's competitive. The other thing that's happening that's fascinating, I'm sure you know all about the big news on the pier with Chicago Shakespeare Theater
taking
over the Skyline stage.
Yeah.
That's going to be an 800-seat theater. So that's coming online, Justin. And that's a big new venue.
The Shakespeare
venue.
Theater right now is, what, 300, 400?
Yeah, like 4-5, something like that for the main stage.
So that's, this is a huge
potentially, in some configurations. So that's a big new – they've got a program that year-round.
Right.
That's sucking a lot of demand.
Does that mean that
we're
no longer going to have that weird Cirque du Soleil
knockoff?
That's gone.
That's dead. That's so dead. I came by once during the lunch break for that. They were all, I almost stopped in, but they had like, yeah, they had like walk on the, they had like a bunch of walks. I was like, this is cool.
It was like their go-to summer hit. It was like, yo, we're just going to have this. I don't even think it was Cirque du Soleil. I think it was like a, like,
no, in a Cirque Shanghai.
Yeah, Cirque Shanghai. That's what
Cirque
it was.
Cirque Shanghai.
Yeah,
and they had, but right, they did have the Wheel of Death. Yeah. Which was the motorcycle, you know, and the, I'm a big fan of the Wheel of Death. Oh, yeah. I'm a bit of a circus freak, but I like to see at least six cycles.
Yeah.
They were five.
Yeah, that's no good. Now, and you need someone who's like, oh, they're going to try six. You need the circus
the voice.
Barker. Yeah.
And
this never been done before.
No. One of the only.
I saw a Wheel of Death. You'd love this. At the Edinburgh Fringe, I saw a Wheel of Death with dirt bikes. I think it was Frankenstein. See, the Frankenstein or Cinderella. It was a play.
In the show?
And they made the play essentially Dirt Bike's Wheel of Death. I don't know how they did it, and it was so stupid.
Well, there's a guy who has the big cage, and he goes around. He's like, look, you can make a Wheel of Death in this. Let's make this a Wheel of Death. Long day's journey into night. Give it a Wheel of Death. Hamlet, Wheel of Death.
There's one Wheel of Death promoter who's just like, you can do any theater.
Any theater.
All right.
On the down low. Only on the down low.
Chris Jones, chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, closing out the highbrow.
Getting fired here on the down low.
Yeah, right.
Thanks a lot.
Getting fired up. Good to see you, man.
Good to
see you.
See you. Thanks, Justin.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Patty Vasquez is up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. We will be off tomorrow and Monday, but we will be back on Tuesday night for election coverage here. Nobody does 2016 like 720, so we will be here with all the results for the local races, the national races. We'll have people in studio. We'll get the winners and losers on the phone. Maybe we'll try to get them in studio. So you got to leave your party, man. You lost. Nobody cares. Drive over to Michigan Avenue. We'll have you on.